This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Memorial Day, we commemorate those who died in war. Today, we have an interview from our archives about photojournalists who died or disappeared while covering war. In 1997, I spoke with Tim Page and Horst Voss, two photojournalists who were wounded in Vietnam but survived. They edited the 1997 book Requiem, which is a memorial to the 135 journalists who lost their lives or disappeared while covering the wars in Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The book collects some of the extraordinary pictures these journalists gave their lives for. Tim Page is an English freelance photographer who first started taking pictures of war in Southeast Asia at the age of 18. He was wounded 4 times while covering the war in Vietnam. He's worked for wire services and magazines. Horst Voss is a German photographer and editor with the Associated Press. He was the AP's chief photographer in Southeast Asia from 1962 to 74. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes. He's now AP's senior editor in London. Page and Voss knew many of the photographers represented in the book Requiem. I asked what impact it had on them when a colleague was killed while taking pictures. Page answered first.
I think probably in Vietnam we became a little inured in a certain sense, and you went on and surfed over the trauma of it, the emotion of it, because should you let that trauma or emotion dominate your existence, then it'd be damnly difficult to go back out in the field and make more pictures. You didn't make light of it. You became very, very sad and very reminiscent about the person, but had to make light of it, or else you could not go out and function again.
Horst Voss, did you find that when you had a friend or a colleague who was killed in Vietnam, a photojournalist who was killed, would it make you any more or less cautious in your own work?
I was trying to be cautious from day one. I had covered other wars before, and I knew it was dangerous. As an agency reporter and head of the photo operation of an agency as AP, and these days the death of somebody always for a very brief while stopped all the activity. I mean, people talked to each other, and I talked immediately about this person, and nothing much happened in the AP bureau, but this time was really very short, and then everybody tried to get back to work almost more determinedly than before. For the photo editor himself, who was possibly the one who sent the killed colleague out on the assignment, there was a lot to do. The body had to be brought home. The family had to be informed and talked to. We attended funerals in the beginning, and we tried to bury the mourning somehow under activity. Do you understand?
Wait, wasn't that sometimes your responsibility? Weren't you often the assigning editor who had to take care of that?
It was my responsibility to deal with headquarters, explain to headquarters what had happened, and then talk to the family, talk to the wives, or talk to parents, and explain what happened, and go out myself to the place where a person was killed and see for myself what happened. I remember going out and trying to find one of our American photographers, Ollie Noon, who had crashed, had been shot down in a helicopter, and took 3-4 days of walking with troops, and troops that were under continuous attack until we reached the helicopter. Well, I found the camera, which had been thrown clear, and the film inside was still intact, but there was almost nothing left of Ollie Noon. So I watched the people that deal with corpses and remains, watched them sorting out the scene. I kept the camera and went back to Saigon and had the difficult task to explain what happened to the parents and the sisters.
What did you say? Do you remember?
No, I think that was very, very private.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think we tried to be honest at the time. We tried to be we tried not to use the normal words of mourning, and I'm very sorry, and so on. He was the greatest. No, we didn't do it. We tried to We try to be very clinically exact what happened, how a person died, possibly saying that there was not much pain, there was just sudden death, and try to be honest. Eh?
Were you ever in a position where you had assigned a photographer to go someplace to take pictures and they were killed on that particular job?
Well, no assignment was an assignment where people were ordered to go to places. We generally assessed the day-to-day situation, and then photographers would go out according to their preferences. So yet Vietnamese who would rather go out with Vietnamese troops. We had other Vietnamese photographers who loved the American Marines. If they did so, then let them go up there.
Did you ever try to talk an AP photographer out of going to a certain place?
Oh, yes, many times. I mean, I myself spent about 50% of my working life in Vietnam in the field. That means I would go out 4 or 5 days and then stay in Saigon 4 or 5 days and play the editor for the others, and then go out myself again and leave another photographer in at the editing desk. We took turns, so we all had our experiences there. I, being a little bit on the senior side already in these days, I was 30 and older, so older than many of the young colleagues, including my friend Paige. I try to warn people. I try to instill to them that they shouldn't go with bad troops. They should rather pull back and take care of themselves and look out for photos when situations became dicey, and never ever be foolishly risking chances.
What are bad troops?
Bad troops are troops that don't take care of themselves. Marines that don't dig in. Patrols that don't put out points, companies that go through the jungle in single file without having flanks out, troops that handle their weapons sloppishly, artillery observers that don't check out the terrain properly, and so on.
Did you find that when you traveled with troops, that they looked after you, or did they see you as a burden, you know, someone who's not a member of the military who's tagging along?
That was one of the main features of a good combat correspondent, combat photographer, not to be a burden to the troops. It started with being equipped and dressed and like soldiers. It means you had to have the right boots, and you have to have your own overnight gear, and you have to carry your own food. The only thing you don't carry is your weapon. You had to protect yourself with a steel helmet and a flak jacket, just like they did. And when there was danger, you could not count on them putting a shield around you and defending you. No? You had to just run with them and hope for the best. But it was not our role to participate in the fighting. On the other side, among the communist photographers, that was their prime role. They were soldiers foremost and reporters, propagandists, or photographers secondary.
When you were photographing combat, what kind of rules of thumb would you use to know when to take pictures and when to just run for cover?
I think it's a cross purpose. You learn where you can. It's a sixth or seventh nature. You learn where you can take pictures from and be safe simultaneously. You learn how to move. Where to position yourself, you learn how to shoot on the run, and this is without the advantage of today's all thinking and singing camera and autofocus. You learn to anticipate, you learn to try to sort of preempt what's going to go on and where you can place yourself. It becomes a sixth or seventh sense in the end. You just automatically know where you know that a rubber tree won't stop a bullet, so you don't hide behind a rubber tree. Admittedly, the opposition can't see you behind the rubber tree, but stray weaponry will come through that rubber tree.
My guests are photojournalists Tim Page and Horst Voss. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page. I spoke with them in 1997 after the publication of their book Requiem. David Halberstam wrote a piece in Vanity Fair in which he talked about you, Horst Voss, and he described you as one of the first photographers in Vietnam to use a Leica, which enabled the photographer to look forward instead of down. Would you describe what that difference was and how that affected your safety and your photographs?
Well, I wasn't the first one to use Leicas. Larry Bowes arrived there almost at the same time, had considerably more Leicas than I had, because at the time AP was still working with large format cameras, and I carried one or two of my own Leicas in there. Well, a Leica camera is a camera where you can keep both eyes open. You can look with the free eye that doesn't look through the viewfinder in all directions, except backwards, and sometimes also backwards. And you can look through the viewfinder and see your picture. So it may be sports photography or may be war photography. The Leica camera at the time appeared to me a camera that made it possible that you were at all times aware of things happening around you.
Tim Page, did you use that too?
Initially, nay. But after I'd made my first spread and had my first spread in Life magazine in mid-65, almost the first thing I did with all this newfound wealth was buy two Leicas in Hong Kong. But it has to be said that almost the first foreign, one of the first foreign photojournalists to be killed in Indochina, Robert Capa, I mean, of World War II fame and Spanish Civil War fame, also used Leicas. I mean, they have been the camera of choice for war photography since, I mean, they were used by the Germans in the Second World War. I mean, Signal magazine consistently had photographers using Leicas and Contaxes. I mean, the Contax looks much like the Leica, much similar technology and lenses. But it's always been the strongest. It's kind of the Rolex of the cameras.
Mm-hmm.
The Rolex cum Volkswagen.
The other wonderful thing with the Leica was that you could actually take it apart like a rifle, clean it out, dry it out, put it together again with a set of little screwdrivers, and it would work again. Something that is impossible with today's electronic chip cameras.
Drying it out when you're in the middle of the jungle was probably a good good thing to do.
No, it happened very often that you fell into a water hole or a river and
bomb craters.
You couldn't operate anymore. Your whole being there was useless. And at that time, if the troops would take a little break, you'd take your cameras apart and put it on a black piece of plastic and hope the sun comes out and dries your cameras out. If not, they go back in a plastic bag and you wait for the next stop and then spread them out again. So sometimes it took a day or two or three to get the stuff working again, and then you were back in operation.
But I can imagine how you must have felt, though, when your camera wasn't operating and you're caught in combat and wondering, or at least I'd be wondering, what am I doing here?
That's right. Yeah.
You spent most of your time saying that anyway.
I could, of course, become a word reporter. That goes for nights. When you're out in a military situation, you can't take pictures at night with flashlights. So at night, and in bad weather and in dark weather, the cameras went back into the fish tackling box, which was waterproof, and I would just use my mind and try to keep quotes there and write down little stories. And many a times I came back without photos, but there's a good memory of a good tale. And I would sit down at the typewriter and write my story for the AP.
Horst Voss, earlier we were talking about your responsibility as an editor at the AP of dealing with a photojournalist's death, calling the family, dealing with the remains of the body. I'm wondering, when a reporter who worked with you at the AP died, what it was like for you to develop their last rolls of film, if you were able to find film on their bodies or in their cameras after their death?
Well, that's very, very difficult to say. I mean, of course, you hope that there's something on this camera that would be worthwhile to be sent out and be a last testimony to a man's a talent that wrote a very important chapter in the history of photojournalism in this century. When a man died, we looked back at his work and we tried to assess what he had achieved and what he had done in his lifetime. The last roll of film was simply like the It was the last paragraph of a story. Of course it's sad, and of course it's everybody comes and looks at it and tries to understand what happened. There's a picture of a young Indian who traveled via Singapore. He desperately wanted to be a reporter, photographer with the AP. He lived only 14 days. When he was on his last military mission, he was up front at the point of a company and on a patrol, and a mine blasted into the company. He didn't have the experience to know that one mine seldom comes alone, so he stood up and photographed American medics helping dying soldiers. While he took his last 6, 7, 8 pictures, a second mine exploded and cut him down, standing up at the time and taking these pictures. So I remember very well his last roll. There were 18 negatives. And the last picture shows clearly that he stood and that he took a picture that he went out there to take, combat, that is. The picture almost explained his death. These last 18 negatives, I remember, were sent on orders from headquarters to the then general manager president of the AP. It was a very detailed explanation how Charlie Chalapa died. Our president wanted to know how it happened again that an AP man died. What could we do better to prevent the repetition of this? Well, there was no answer to my report because nothing was done wrong except that the man shouldn't have stood up after the first mine. So here, the last pictures were telling the tale, and as it happens, they are about the only pictures that are remembered of Charlie Chalapa, one of which is published, his last picture indeed, and published in our book, together with my slightly apologetic message to President Wes Gallagher, why Charlie Chalapa died.
My guests, Horst Voss and Tim Page, are photojournalists who covered the war in Vietnam. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1997 interview with photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page. They were both wounded while covering the war in Vietnam. Their 1997 book, Requiem, collects photos taken by colleagues who did not survive the war. Horst Voss, you were wounded in Vietnam. What was your wound and what impact did that have on your life, your work, your commitment to war photojournalism?
Well, I was wounded in December 1967 by a big rocket fragment that tore through my legs. And thanks to an American medic who somehow pulled me back, and thanks to a tank driver who moved forward and loaded me and brought me back to some clearing, and thanks to a helicopter pilot who came in and picked me up together with some other wounded, and thanks to surgeons who decided not to cut off my leg as I intended to do first. I was aware that I was on the way to recovery 4 or 5 days later. And the only decision I made at that time was not to go to Honolulu or New York or anywhere, but to stay in Vietnam. One reason being that I had total trust in military surgeons who were dealing with these problems day in, day out. And secondly, I tried to avoid having my legs broken again at the New York head office and being made a photo editor at headquarters, because that would have ended the great days of photography. Yeah? Being in Vietnam and being around a major story of the time was always a great shot of adrenaline, and put it frankly, we enjoyed ourselves much of the time.
Well, Tim Page, I believe that you were injured and returned to combat more times than any other photojournalist in Vietnam.
I was hit 4 times, in 1 train wreck and 1 motorcycle wreck and 1 car wreck. After 3 woundings, 2 of them relatively minor, I mean, in combat or out in the field. The third time was fairly serious, and the American Coast Guard cut a shot up by American planes, and about 400 pieces of shrapnel in my body. At that point, Time Life paid for me to leave the country, And I was reassigned, I was given a contract to work out of the Paris office and cover the Six-Day War and other conflicts in the West. But I had to go back in 68 after during the Tet Offensive, just after the Tet Offensive. I couldn't stand there and watch the Tet Offensive go on, as it were, live on television and seeing the pictures in Life magazine or and all my buddies and friends' pictures being used. And I'm sitting in Los Angeles, thumb up my bum and mind in neutral. And I took a one-way ticket back to Vietnam, arriving just in time for the second Tet Offensive, when the press corps lost about 8 people in 3 days. And instantly, I arrived with 50 cents in my pocket, and within 4 days, I had 6 pages in Life magazine. It was something was bigger than we were. I mean, speaking from the freelance point of view, it was the war to be in. And providing you went out enough and got towards where it was hitting the fan, then you could guarantee getting decent spreads into magazines and sell your images, be it to AP or UPI or to one of the other agencies, or you would have a commission for an assignment to one of the major magazines. And that's what you're being paid for, or you were trying to break into that world so you became a known photographer.
You were wounded several times, 4 or 5 times in Vietnam. Kept going back for more. Did you ever feel like you were tempting fate, that you'd come so close that you should just stay away?
Yeah, in 67, it got to that point when Sean Flynn, Errol Flynn's son, and myself were sitting in a bunker just inside the demilitarized zone, the DMZ, on the south side. And we'd gone in with some South Vietnamese airborne forces to retrieve bodies and wounded from when they'd been ambushed the night before. And we were caught by North Vietnamese artillery. And then immediately after that, by friendly fire, American phantom bombers came in and strafed and bombed us. And Sean and I ended up in a little tiny house, a shelter underneath the house, cowering and just terrified. And we both made a pact that we were going to get out of there very, very soon. And I got out within about 6 weeks of that event, and Sean left within a couple of months of that event.
But Sean ended up dying in Vietnam.
He was captured. The whole of this book and the memorial process, remembrance process, started back in 1989, when I went to Cambodia to unearth or to try to discover the fate of what had happened to Dana Stone and Sean Flynn, two photographers. Sean was working at the time for Time, and Dana was working for CBS. And they were captured by North Vietnamese come Viet Cong reconnaissance troops, very close to the South Vietnamese border, but in Cambodia, and were given, after that, at that point, to Khmer Rouge about 4 or 5 months later, and were held for something just over a year, and were finally executed. And a French student who was doing his research on journalism in Southeast Asia managed through the Freedom of Information Act to get details about their demise, these declassified documents from the CIA and DIA, and had sent me copies of these things. And I tried to get as close to the site as possible where they had been executed and held. And at that point, I decided I was going to try to build a memorial to all the media who had been killed or wounded or missing in Indochina from all sides, not just, should we say, from the West, but from the Vietnamese side, North Vietnamese, Viet Cong side, Liberation Front.
Tim, what was the last wound that you got in Vietnam, and why did you stay?
I didn't stay. I mean, on the last wound, I took a piece of shrapnel in my brain, and they took out of my brain 200, about the size of an orange, 200 cubic centimetres of brain, which left me paralysed, hemiplegic on the left side for over a year. When I was brought out of the field by helicopter and on the way to the next medical post, I was declared dead, and they had to jumpstart my heart a couple of times. And the hemorrhage at the point when they started to open my head up, as I said, got to the size of a large orange. And I was dead at that time, so I'm told. I mean, I can't actually recall much about that, to be quite honest.
How good has your recovery been?
A It's a bit of a limp. I don't know if you ever really recover from something like that. You always, yeah, you recover physically. I mean, I've been back to Vietnam 27 times. I was there this year for 3 or 4 weeks. But my agility has always been impaired since. Mentally, I suppose it gives you the strength to go on and do other things. Maybe something like this project. I mean, one can only say that, you know, with the grace of God go I. I mean, one is alive, and you can't sit and somehow weep and gnash and wail about that dilemma in the past. It's over.
Tim Page and Horst Voss edited the book Requiem, a collection of pictures by photojournalists who died or disappeared in the wars in Southeast Asia. Our interview was recorded in 1997 when the book was published.